From 2008 to 2014, Garpax rarely explored the trade market. They chose to build their roster in free agency in the draft. Many of the deals they did make focused on shedding players. For instance, in February 2009, they traded veterans Larry Hughes, Drew Gooden, and Andres Nocioni to shed salary and increase minutes for younger players. In the deal that shipped out Gooden and Nocioni, the Sacramento Kings gave up John Salmons and Brad Miller. Both Salmons and Miller proved to be vital sparks down the stretch for the Bulls, helping the team make the playoffs and battle the Boston Celtics to 7 games in a classic opening round series. A year later, the Bulls again did some dealing. With their eyes set on the 2010 free agency sweepstakes, they parted with Salmons, trading him to the Milwaukee Bucks for Hakeem Warrick and Joe Alexander. They also pulled the plug on the Tyrus Thomas experience, sending him to the Charlotte Bobcats for Flip Murray, AC Law, and a future first round pick. For the rest of this period, Garpax only pulled off 2 more notable trades. They sent Kyle Korver to the Atlanta Hawks for a trade exception and cash in 2012, and they traded Luol Deng to the Cleveland Cavaliers in 2014, dealing him for Andrew Bynum and future draft picks, including the right to swap 2015 first rounders. Both were underwhelming deals given the value both players possessed at the time of their departure. The front office's trade resume during this period was lackluster to say the least. Could they have done more? It's hard to say. Reports from the period connected the Bulls to plenty of all-star caliber players. There was Amari Stoudemire in the winter of 2009, Jason Richardson and Carmelo Anthony in the fall of 2010, and Dwight Howard and James Harden in the offseason of 2012. Were any of these real opportunities or just pipe dreams? We'll never know for sure. However, it was well documented that Garpax were reluctant to part with key pieces like Luol Deng or Joakim Noah in a wide variety of trade proposals that were offered to them. It certainly takes two to tango, so it's difficult to say if players like Deng or Noah, had they been packaged with draft picks, would have been enticing enough to land a star player. Still, you have to wonder what these Bulls teams would have looked like had Garpax been more active pursuing bigger trades. All right, so let's start in 2009. Did you ever anticipate that the Andres Nocioni trade that netted John Salmons and Brad Miller would actually catapult the Bulls into the playoff picture? Both were big down the stretch and into that Celtics series. So I'll start with you, Dave. Did you actually think that was going to springboard them to the playoffs?
No, I don't think anybody thought those two names together would springboard you into any kind of playoffs ever, whatever team they go to. You don't think you got John Salmons and Brad Miller. All right, we set. Let's go. Like, at least I'm not. I mean, I can't think of anybody who would think that way. And I like John Salmons even before he got to the Bulls. Like, Chris and I would talk about him just the way he played. It was always very slow, but you couldn't stop it. It was like watching that old guy at the court. You know what I'm saying? If you know what I'm saying, you go up to the court, you see that old dude, like, man, this dude's slow, but you can't do anything about it. He's scoring 40. And you know, tell me, are you tired, young boy? You tired? You know, I'm talking to you while you're doing it. So that was John Salmon's kind of game. And Brad Miller, I mean, the value that he brought to this team, man, just not even on the court, but just the toughness, you know what I'm saying, and the identity that he helped bring to this team, and how he shaped Joakim Noah when he got here and everything like that. Like, those kind of things. He was kind of a guy ahead of his time a little bit, because he was also a 3-point shooter and a pretty solid one. You know, he wasn't terrible at it. Like, when he would shoot those threes, you weren't like, no, Brad, no. You know, it wasn't like Robin Lopez or somebody shooting him. It wasn't a comical thing. You know what I'm saying? It was like, oh, look at that big guy shooting. You know, it was like, no, you better get out there. Brad Miller can hit that. And he could play, like, and he was tough and he was strong. And yeah, man, like, having him on the team along with John Salmons, man, who John Salmons could get you like 30. He would score 30 on you. He would definitely do that. So it was a really good trade, because you just didn't see that catapulting them. That's a great word for it. Catapulting them into the playoff picture. But that's exactly what happened. But no, I didn't see it happening at all.
No, I didn't. Brad Miller, I was very unfamiliar with Brad Miller, actually. Salmons, I knew, could play a little bit. I didn't know that he could play that well, you know, given, you know, the chance to, you know, shoot a little bit more on a team that needed it. He produced day in, night in, night out. You know, made some big shots and some big plays for him. Brad Miller, I was very unfamiliar with Brad Miller. And to my surprise, man, that man, he was very heady. He was very skilled. Mm. You know, could pass a little bit. You know, could really jump, but good rebounds. You know, he made the tough plays at the right time. No, I didn't see them propel them to the playoffs. But they were kind of like that. You know, when free agents come to a team, they play hard, look good for a week, and then they disappear. They look good and play hard continuously throughout the year. So it was like, oh, okay, this is not a 2-week thing. This is like how they play. And it was a surprise to see, especially Salmons become that score. But we saw Salmons hit this wall in the playoffs where he couldn't quite hit the next level of offensive offensive play. That spin move only went so far until he got ripped up in the playoffs with it.
So similar to the free agency stuff we were talking about earlier, there were some missed opportunities with trades in this portion of the Garpax era. And, you know, we brought up opportunities maybe to go after guys like, you know, Dwight Howard and James Harden. Carmelo Anthony, I don't know if you remember this, he was rumored right before the beginning of the 2010-11 season to be on the trade market, and there were some rumblings that maybe the Bulls might jump in. There was rumblings with Jason Richardson, but nothing happened. Why do you think they were always reluctant to part with pieces on the roster to get another weapon to go with Rose? I'll start with you, Chris.
Well, like I said, they always seem to, you know, the key word was core back then, and they always seem to overvalue what they obtained, you know, through their own means, so to speak. When you overvalue what you have, hopefully that they learned from the past, especially the, you know, going forward, that you can't keep, you know, make it so personal with the players you have. You have to give up something of value to get something back, even if you drafted a person or you feel like a personal relationship with that individual player, as far as, you know, tying that player to your career as a GM. I guess that's why hubris and misevaluation of talent. You know, I always throughout these years didn't understand how they overvalued Luol Deng. You know, it's crazy to me how they overpaid Kirk Heinrich, but devalued Ben Gordon. You know, Tim Thomas is on damn list. God, motherfucker. You know, they overvalue Tyrus Thomas, obviously, because he's, you know, they get Aldridge, whatever. Yeah, just a lot of overvaluing the talent and perhaps thinking that next year was the year instead of winning now, so to speak. But, like, you know, some of these players, like Josh Smith, man, I didn't want Josh Smith. I mean, you know, whatever. Dwight Howard, yeah. I like Jason Richardson, but, you know, he didn't play well, you know, in long streaks in the career. Especially the Kirk Heinrich thing, overvaluing him is just crazy. My goodness. So that's basically the case of why I think they just had to take the emotion out of it, you know, make it a business and pull the switch. But they couldn't do it.
I agree with that, Chris. That's a really good way to put it. They had this thing about the core and they just loved it and they loved all their guys. And the Bulls always had this thing also where, you know, they just always had to make the right deal. Like they always had to, you know, get the right deal. It had to be the correct one. And this is what happens sometimes when you're always trying to make the right deal is sometimes you're waiting, and that when you're waiting, stuff will pass you. You know, like they say, study long, study wrong. Like sometimes you just got to make the move, you know what I'm saying, and go for it. And the Bulls, a lot of times, were very reluctant to do that. And I also think that them having a guy like Derrick Rose, I guess they felt that, well, let's see if we can win. Because maybe this wasn't their doing or what they were doing, but it kind of looked like how they were doing Mike back in the day. You remember, Chris and Matt, how Jordan just didn't have anybody around him. And for quite a few years, and he was just carrying them on his back, and he didn't complain about it. He just did his job, and that's what it was going to be. And it kind of seemed like that's what it was going on for Derek. Not for that long. It wasn't going on for, you know, because Mike, it went on for like, I don't know, about what, 5 years until they finally, you know, said, oh my goodness, he needs some help. But it was long enough to be alarming and long enough for me to be glaring. It's the reason LeBron left. You know what I'm saying? It's the reason LeBron walked away from Cleveland. It's like, dude, you ain't giving me no help. I'm not doing this anymore. Now, luckily, Derrick Rose didn't have that mentality. And I think they were kind of using that also to say, well, Derrick will be here and he's going to play hard for us regardless. But we want to get the right guy, not the right now guy. We want to get the right guy to put around Derrick. And then they passed on so many guys who could have, you know, really helped at that point in time for the Bulls. So I think that's all it was. They were waiting too long and waiting on the right bus, and that bus never came. And, you know, it just didn't work out for them that way. Just the over-evaluation of talent and over-evaluation of those guys that they have on a bench that they just love, you know. The crowd loves them. The fans love them. You know, yeah, we love these guys. Notioni was over-evaluated for a bit. And Chris was like, let him go. Like get him out of here, dude. Like, get Notioni out of here. Like, for some reason, they weren't able at that time to see the ceiling of some of these guys, like Chris Mitchell, Luol Deng, and see, like, okay, it's going to be over after this point, or the decline is going to start at this point. We should make this move, or he's not a guy players are like, I want to come play with him. Oh, he's there? Oh, I need to come play with him. Oh, Notch is there? Oh, yeah, we coming to play with Notch. Like, no, it's not like that. So, yeah, I think that overvaluation just really hurt them.
Maybe I'm a little more of a maverick, because if it were me, I would be approaching this like how Jerry West just approached the Kawhi Leonard signing. If I know I'm getting a guy like Kawhi Leonard and I have such a talented player that's coming to my team, and I got to get Paul George to make it work, and I got to give up 5 draft choices, well then, damn it, I'm giving up 5 draft choices. I don't care. And I feel like that never happened. Like, when James Harden hit the market in 2012, I mean, you remember that package included a lot of draft picks and I think Kevin Martin. Couldn't the Bulls have thought of maybe throwing in Luol Deng and a myriad of draft picks to try and make something happen? I'm just like, it never seemed to be on the Bulls' radar, and everybody would always throw the Bulls in as a rumored team because they were a contender, but it never seemed like Garpax ever stepped up to the plate.
Hey, I remember Dave, when I started with you, I recommended trading Noah after the MVP year.
Yeah, I remember you said that. Yep.
I was like, do you know how much you get for this guy? Is I said he peaked. People will give anything for him right now.
I told you
anything.
And I was like, Chris, they can't do it.
I'll drop him like, dude, you could have got so much for Joakim Noah.
Spoiler alert, next episode, that's going to be one thing that's brought up when we look at the beginning of the 14 off season. And, you know, there was a Kevin Love rumor going around, and Joakim Noah might have been a piece to bring that in.
Lord. I remember it, though. He's right.
We got more to love. And I'm not, you agree with me, but your heart, you love Noah so much as a player, as a fan. Yeah. You're like, I want to see him in the Bulls. But
I was like, and the Bulls would never do that. Like, I was like, that's all I kept saying. Like, yes, I love Noah. I didn't want him to go. I knew that was the right move. But I was like, he can't. The Bulls would never, ever do something like that because of the sheer joy and the resentment also that would happen from the fans. You know what I'm saying? Not just the sheer joy he brought to the fans, and then the resentment that front office will get. And the people already hated them at that time, like they don't hate them now. But like, people were really hating them. So them trading away their favorite behind Derrick Rose, like, come on. No, man.
I even said at the time that once he leaves Chicago, he's going to fall apart, and we're going to run away laughing at all the assets we got for him. Mm-hmm. People gonna and look what happened.
I wanted to ask you guys, because there's two trades that I always think where maybe the Bulls could have gotten more. And I want your opinion on which one was a little worse. Trading Kyle Korver to the Atlanta Hawks for basically a trade exception, or trading Luol Deng for Andrew Bynum and a bunch of heavily restricted and protected picks.
You know what? For me, the Luol Deng trade was worse only because it should have happened years before. And to get that kind of return was just super frustrating to me because Chris, I'm sure all of us know what they could have gotten if they had just decided to let him go a little bit earlier than that. Kyle Korver is Kyle Korver. Like, you know, it's Kyle Korver. Whatever you trade Kyle Korver for, it's not going to be like end of the world. I don't think you get fleeced if you trade Kyle Korver for anything. That's just my opinion. If you trade, because he's a great 3-point shooter. We know what he is, but we know what Kyle Korver is. You know what I'm saying? You know his role. This is why he's been on, you know, that's why his closet just looks amazing, because there's so many NBA jerseys in there. He's been on a ton of teams, man. He's been on a ton of teams, and there's a reason for that. But Luol Deng was that dude. I mean, he was. I mean, when your name is mentioned with Kobe Bryant, people are looking at you like you're that dude. And we were like, oh man, the Bulls need to trade him and let him go. And they held on to him, again, over evaluating the talent, held on to him way too long, almost ended his life, and just held on him way too long, man. So getting nothing for him just hurt, because you know what they could have gotten for him.
I just had a flashback to all those that your whole year, Dave. What was the flash? What we say all year? We should trade Luol Deng. We should trade Luol Deng.
All year.
We should trade him 2 years ago. Oh, we got a whole bunch from him. I was like, we should trade Noah. I'm like, what are they doing? They're wasting. This is when you trade these players when they're highly valued. We put people overvaluing them. You get a lot back. And they just didn't understand that. It's like the front office just wouldn't admit that he could get a lot back for the whole day. They're so attached to him emotionally. But yeah, we sound like, you know, repeating ourselves here, but it was so frustrating that they were so emotionally tied to these draft picks that they just couldn't understand that they could improve the team if they just trade him a year or two earlier. They could have fleeced a bunch of dumb GMs. He thought GMs were dumb today. Oh my God. And Liz was not around as it is now. It was so dumb. Dude, some dumbest trades in the world that happened. Eventually, you got to put Noah and Luol Deng. You traded them 2 years earlier.
Mm-hmm. So, in totality, if we were to look at, you know, those early trades, 2009, 2010, but then looking at the lack of trades that were made and just some of the weird moves that were made late in this period, how would you? I'll start with you, Dave. On a scale of 1 to 5, how would you rate trades in this era for Garpax?
Trades in the era for Garpax, I would give a 1.5. I like that you got Salmons. I like that you got Miller. Okay. And then I'm like, that's the highlight. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's where I'm at right now as far as a highlight for trades during that era. All the guys that you kind of missed out on and didn't get. I mean, I'm looking at names like Michael Ruffin and, you know what I'm saying? You know, like Chris's favorite player, Tim Thompson, and, you know, James Johnson and Devin Brown. And, you know what I'm saying? Like, come on, man. You know, getting Flip Murray and AC Long. Come on. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is who we were getting to trade. You know, and then you have to wait and wonder what trade was worse. You know what I'm saying? When you're asking about Kyle Korver and Luol Deng. Like, that's the big question, like, oh, which was worse? You know, and those aren't players that are super, you know, great. So it was nothing just off the chain. I give them 1.5 because of Brad Miller and Salmons and what they meant to the playoffs. That's the reason they get that 0.5. But yeah, I'm gonna give them 1.5 on that.
What about you, Chris?
Yeah, I'm gonna give them a 2, maybe 1.75. No, okay, I give them a 2 because again, we talked about the trades that they didn't make, you know, not understanding the talent you had on your team, understanding the ceiling of the players, and not letting go emotionally, and and not being creative, right? That's the big buzzword back then. They weren't creative, you know, believing in something that wasn't there. It was like a cult or something, like this core thing. Who cares? Like, trade somebody. So the trade they didn't make, they get a 2. For the trade they made, they get a 2.
Yeah, and I'm going to go actually with the 2 also. And a little different. So, like, the 09 trade, I think, is a redeeming quality. But also, in 2010, when they had traded Tyrus Thomas and gotten that first-round pick for him, that's actually pretty impressive. So I'm giving them – I probably would have given them a 1, but I'm going to give them a 1 extra point for making that shrewd move and getting something for a wasted draft pick, really. So to recap for trades, Dave with a 1.5, and Chris and myself give Garpax a 2 out of 5. So I'm going to go now into our last category, the coaching decisions. All right. When you think of coaching during this period of Bulls basketball, Tom Thibodeau should be the only name that comes to mind, but the story prior to his arrival is still worth discussing. After a disappointing 2008 season, the Bulls were looking for an established coach to lead their young core of Kirk Heinrich, Ben Gordon, Luol Deng, and Joakim Noah. John Paxson had his eyes set on Mike D'Antoni, whose fast-paced offense seemed like a nice fit for a young squad like the Bulls. However, owner Jerry Reinsdorf held up the negotiations with D'Antoni, and he ultimately ended up with the New York Knicks. Paxson was forced to pick from the other names on his list. Tom Thibodeau was one of those names. Thibodeau, an assistant with the Boston Celtics at the time, was someone Pax had always coveted, even dating back to 2003, when he looked to add him as an assistant to Bill Cartwright's staff. While he would have been a solid choice for the Bulls in 2008, Thibodeau, however, opted to turn down all interview requests to focus on the Celtics' playoff run. So who was next? Paxson targeted his former coach, Doug Collins. Collins, who was broadcasting for TNT at the time, had coached the Bulls from 1986 to 1989 and was credited by many in the organization for building a winning culture prior to the dynasty. While Collins had a reputation for turning around losing situations, he also had an equal reputation for burning out easily. Shortly after May's draft lottery, Collins had agreed in principle to be the Bulls' new head coach. But following discussions with Jerry Reinsdorf, both decided it would be best if Collins didn't take the job for the sake of their friendship. Again, Paxson was back at square one, but at a very inopportune time. The calendar turned to June, and all the noteworthy names were gone. After interviewing Sacramento Kings assistant Chuck Person and former Minnesota Timberwolves coach Dwayne Casey, Pax instead went an unconventional route. Just weeks before the draft in June 2008, the Bulls hired Vinny Del Negro. Del Negro, who played 12 years in the NBA, had no coaching experience at any level and was serving as assistant GM of the Phoenix Suns at the time. While Del Negro led the Bulls to two straight playoff appearances, his lack of coaching experience showed. Del Negro drew criticism for consistently keeping Derrick Rose on the bench in key situations throughout his rookie season. And those plays he drew up after timeouts? Well, they were pretty laughable. Rumors swirled in the 2009-10 season that Del Negro would be fired at season's end. Things took a turn for the worse later that season when Joakim Noah returned from a bout with plantar fasciitis. During a game that spring against the Phoenix Suns, Del Negro played Noah more minutes than the team doctors prescribed. Paxson confronted Del Negro after the game, and the two got into a physical altercation, which resulted in Paxson choking and punching his head coach. Del Negro was indeed dismissed after the season. During the 2010 offseason, there were many intriguing names available, but a familiar one was starting to stand out from the rest, Tom Thibodeau. Thibodeau was a hot name again, and this time he was taking interviews. Paxson, Reinsdorf, and GM Gar Forman met with Thibs in LA while the Celtics were in the NBA Finals. Just days after the interview, he agreed to be the Bulls' new head coach. Thibodeau seemed like the right coach at the right time. During this period, he helped transform the Bulls into Eastern Conference contenders. Armed with a healthy Derrick Rose in his first year at the helm, Thibodeau led the Bulls to the best record in the league. While Rose earned MVP honors, Thibs also took home some hardware of his own, winning Coach of the Year. Despite losing to the Miami Heat in the Eastern Conference Finals, the Bulls bounced back with a strong 2012 campaign, finishing again with the league's best record. Unfortunately, an ACL injury to All-Star Derrick Rose derailed their title hopes, and the Bulls were bounced in round one by the Philadelphia 76ers. Injuries became a familiar story as Thibodeau's coaching tenure grew. Rose would miss the entire 2013 season and all but 10 games in the 2014 season. Nagging injuries to other key pieces like Luol Deng, Kirk Heinrich, and Joakim Noah also made it difficult for the Bulls to crack into title contention. Still, Thibodeau got the most out of his roster during this period of Bulls basketball. The team always won 45 or more games with him in charge, and were always near or at the top of the league in defensive rating. Despite the success, tension between Thibodeau and Garpak started to mount. Thibodeau started to question moves being made by the front office, particularly by GM Gar Forman. The front office, meanwhile, questioned Thibodeau's handling of players' minutes. Things got ugly around 2013. Despite agreeing to a contract extension in the fall of 2012, Thibodeau chose not to sign the contract until after the season, claiming he wanted his lawyers to review it. Shortly after that incident, Gar Forman chose not to retain Thibodeau's top assistant, Ron Adams. As the 2014 season concluded, with another injury-riddled campaign and early playoff exit, it was obvious Thibodeau's days as head coach were numbered. All right, so I got to start with this question. How much time did the Bulls waste with Vinny Del Negro? Because Derek and that roster could have probably benefited a lot more from D'Antoni and Doug Collins. So I'll start with you, Chris. I mean, Vinny Del Negro, waste of time?
Well, obviously, yes. He was a waste of time. Yeah, so... Yeah. Like when you say, Dave, when your father has to go and coach for you on the bench or something like that, you shouldn't.
Come on, Chris. You should see me right now rocking back and forth. Come on. NBA.
And we didn't understand what Vinny was doing. Sometimes it worked. We didn't know why. It just seemed random. But not playing Joker. No. Yeah. It's just, no. I'm sorry. Let's move on.
You thought I snapped off about Draymond Green. Look here. Look here, man.
Step up on the soapbox.
I could stand Vinny Del Negro. He was just trash personified to me. I just could not stand that dude at all. I never hated the word pace so much in my life. Like, he said it all the time, and I couldn't stand it. And I remember... I remember talking to C. Red Fred about Vinny, and Fred was always telling me, well, you know, I give Vinny credit because, you know, he let Derek play. I'm like, yeah, that's because he's not blind. Like, obviously he's got eyes, and he can say, oh, who do I choose, Derek Rose or Kirk Heinrich to play? Well, yo, duh, I'm going to choose the dude that dunks over people.
Whoa, hold on. Derek Rose's rookie season, there were plenty of moments where Kirk Heinrich was playing well into the fourth quarter and in crucial stretches of the game, and Derek would be sitting on the bench. So I don't know what Fred's talking about there. That's not true at all.
I think he's giving him love just for the playoffs. I think that's what Fred's trying to give him love for. I'm like, it took him that long to figure that out. Like, it took him that long. We got to wait to the playoffs to come and then say, oh, you know what? I think this guy's got something. He probably asked his dad. His dad probably told him, you know, I think you should start playing as Derek Rose.
Do you remember his dad being on the sidelines during the Boston series? It was so freaking awkward.
Do you remember your father showing up and saying, I got it from his son? And not only did he showed up with a Bulls coaching shirt on. Like, he was part of the staff. That wasn't just a Bulls shirt that you could just buy at the store. That's like a coach shirt.
Oh, that's not Del Harris. It's...
He showed up on the sideline like he was about to call plays. Like, he was taking over in the huddle. And Vinny is like, okay, no, it's cool. My pops is here. Like, what? How you just like, it's cool. Let that go. In the playoffs! How you just let that go? That makes no sense. Why does the NBA have to get in here and regulate and tell you, hey, man, I don't think you should have your parent who's not a part of the organization coaching in the playoffs on your team? Oh, my God!
We got lucky, though, because right after that, you ended up with a really, really good coach in Tom Thibodeau. And I'll start with you, Dave. What was your best memory of Thibs' Bulls coach?
Oh, man, that's a great question. Best memory of Thibs was probably the Nate Robinson year, like when Derrick Rose got hurt that year, because the lineups with Bellinelli and Joakim Noah, actually two seasons. So that season, when they played the Nets in Game 7, I called it the spit, glue, grease team. Like, because that team just put together the spit, glue, and grease. And what Tibbs did for them, not just defensively, but offensively, him playing Joakim Noah at point center, something that didn't even exist. Like, people do was playing point center out here, man. And the way he played Nate Robinson at the two and let Bellinelli run the one, the schemes that he came up with on the offensive end, the way those guys played, playing Jimmy Butler, playing just never, ever sitting out a game. Like, Jimmy Butler played all the time. He would sit out for like 1 minute. And I remember it would be overtime games, Jimmy Butler would play like 1 minute. Now, you knew this wasn't going to end well for any of those guys' knees. Like, we knew that. We knew it was not going to end well. But he had to do it because they had nothing. I never saw so many point guards who you thought couldn't play come in here and just ball. John Lucas III came in here, ball. DJ Augustine came in here and ball. You know what I'm saying? Like, he was great. He was like a point guard whisperer at that time. But that
he made guys a lot of money.
A ton of money. Like that. So that season, and then the Joakim Noah season, the very next year, when Joakim Noah won Defensive Player of the Year and was first team All NBA and an All Star, those two seasons were my two favorite years of Tibbs here. I thought out of the years Tibbs here, how long was it? 5 years? Mm-hmm. I think four out of those 5 years, I thought he was coach of the year. You know what I'm saying? Like, cause just of the way that he did it, like, it was unbelievable the things he had to put together because he didn't have the talent around him because they were always hurt. Now, also, those injuries were partly a part of him also. But yeah, he just put stuff together very well.
With the Bulls, especially that Joakim Noah year, it felt like every time I missed something, like, you're like, we drew a play. It felt like he was drawing the most remarkable play ever, the man known to mankind, and somehow this roster was going to execute it to the best of his ability. And I just appreciated that. I felt when a timeout was called, and when the 2 minutes was used up as maximum value, you know, after a timeout or the team was playing. Was playing defense, he knew that it was Tibbs that sort of like embodied what the team felt like on the court. Maybe it wasn't true after all these years, but at that time, it sure felt that way. It felt like he was really the conductor, and really the players were actually, you know, playing the instruments, and it really felt what the felt Tibbs body personified on the floor. You say grit and the roster of people injured and Luol Deng paying 80 minutes a game and whatever. Like you mentioned, Joe Kanoa, he puts Joe Kanoa at point guard, basically, has an offense around him and has the offense run through him. And just when things were going good and going bad, you really felt like you had a coach that could actually coach the Bulls out of them in the situation.
So we knew that things were sort of brewing with management as things went on. We know that they agreed to a contract extension. Thibs waited to sign it. And then Ron Adams gets fired, his top assistant. Should management have done more to make things work with Thibs? Even though Thibs could be difficult to work with. There's a lot of stories that document that. And I'll start with you, Chris. Do you think management should have done more to make it work? Or do you think Thibs was just headed for burnout at some point?
Listen, when Ron Adams got fired, nothing went right for the Bulls since. And when you fire somebody's best friend, that's personal. Mm-hmm. That's like, because literally, after Ron Adams got fired, nothing worked for the Bulls, basically. I mean, it's like they dropped off. It was a level of drop. Something happened. Something's missing. The defense, it wasn't quite there anymore. Was that Ron Adams? What was that Tibbs? Maybe Ron Adams. You know, and so when you make that, When you substitute money and you had to make him sort of paired against, you know, a personal friend, that's vindictive and that's hard. Like that's hard. So I don't know, and I'm pretty sure that the Bulls gave Tibbs a lot of leeway, and I'm pretty sure they told him plenty of times about the minutes and all this stuff. And it became this tiff attack kind of thing over the years. And maybe, you know, looking back, you had to sort of want, maybe as the boss, you have to say, I have talent here. I had to give in. But it seems like no one wanted to give in. Maybe John Paxson and Tibbs, there's not personalities that didn't match at all. So maybe it was just a personality issue with John Paxson and GM. Because he did, you know, run up on Jim Vinny Del Negro. Huh. And so he was a hard ass. Mm. So I'm pretty sure he wouldn't give in. I think at some point someone had to give in for the betterment of the team. And Tibbs, but Tibbs wanted more and more control and more credit.
Oh man, should they have done more to make it work? I would say yes, but I would say yes on both sides though. But yeah, management, yeah, they definitely should have done more, could have done more to make it work. Like Chris said, I mean, they traded his best friend for no reason. Like they just got Ron Adams out of there and for no reason at all. It felt like just a power play kind of move. You know what I'm saying? Like, oh, you won't do things our way? Well, we're going to take out your best friend. Like it's the Godfather or something. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So when you do that and then you didn't adhere to his request about Draymond Green, you know, and things of that nature, of course, when you tell him, hey, you shouldn't play these guys a certain amount of minutes, why would he listen to you? Seriously. Like, why would he be like, oh yeah, I got it. I got you. I understand. Tibbs is not that kind of personality. He obviously is a guy just like them. And sometimes that's a problem because that means you have the same issues. You know what I'm saying? And just two bulls ramming horns together all the time. Like, I'm going to play them even harder just because you told me I need to sit them down. I play him to his leg snap off, you know, and then I play him in the overtime after that happens. So, yeah, it was just the guys were stubborn. Both of them were very, very stubborn and very hard-nosed. In my head, they had a Rocky Apollo Creed moment where they, you know, got into a boxing ring and nobody was around and just fought. But that's just, you know, that's just how I feel. You know what I'm saying? Like, they just had that moment. But yeah, it just couldn't get along, but they could have done more. They could have done more to make it work. But Tibbs also, though, like, Tibbs wasn't, you know, the nicest guy either.
If we had to take the, again, taking everything into account, except, I want to put this caveat in here, not Thibs getting fired, because, you know, Thibs remained the coach into our next part. But if we take everything into account, the hirings and firings that happened in this period, we'll start with you, Dave, on a scale of 1 to 5, how would you rate coaching decisions during this period?
Well, Tibbs gets you a high grade just for what he did while he was here. But Vinny drops it down for you for what he did. But without Vinny, there'd be no Tibbs. So I'm going to give the Bulls, oh, man, I want to say a 3.75. I don't want to give him a 4 because I don't want Vinny to have that 4 at all. But I'm going to go ahead and give him a 4. Because just of how amazing Tibbs was and the great job that he did coaching from the minute that he got here, from the second he got here, everything changed. And it changed for the better for the team for a while. And he provided some really excellent moments. But, man, Vinny was just the worst.
Okay, Chris?
Yeah, I'm not going to go high as a 4. I was thinking about 3.5 or 3. I haven't decided yet. Because, you know, granted, they did find Tibbs. They still had a rocky relationship. And that's key to, you know, having a stable workplace. Because I heard yeah, I heard Tibbs was disturbing the workplace, for crying out loud. And that matters to a certain extent. Even, you know, De Negro, you have to pretty much fight your coach. You know, that's not good. So the talent, yes. The relationship part of it, not good. It affecting the team, obviously did when you fire Wright Adams, and the team has to constantly address playing for Tibbs. So I'm going to give them not quite a 4 to me. I'm going to
3.5.
Yeah.
I'm going to give them a 4 just on Tibbs alone, because that to me is, you know, that's pretty impressive to have that coach. And that was a coach that John Paxson originally wanted in 2008, so it's kind of interesting. I think had John Paxson gotten his first choice, you know, Tom Thibodeau might have been here a little sooner. Maybe he gotten fired sooner, but he would have been here sooner. So, as I'm adding that up right now, Dave, you gave for drafts a 4 out of 5, for free agency 2.5 out of 5, trades 1.5 out of 5, and coaching 4 out of 5. So that tallies up to 12 out of 20. Chris, you put him at a 4.5 out of 5, a 3 out of 5, a 2 out of 5 on trades, and a 3.5 out of 5 on coaching. That brings them to a 13 out of 20. I also have him at 13 out of 20 because I went with a 4 out of 5 on drafts, 3 out of 5 on free agency, 2 out of 5 on trades, and 4 out of 5 on coaching. So, pretty low grades, but again, like, some of that gets weighed down a lot by some of the oddball moves here. I wanted to end this with just quick final questions. I'll start with you, Dave. How close do you think the Bulls were to winning a title during this period of the Garpacks era? We talked about it a little bit earlier, but how close do you think they really were?
I mean, they were close. I mean, they got to the Eastern Conference Championship. I mean, that's as close. I mean, that's pretty close to getting there. But here's the problem. LeBron James is in your conference. I mean, I didn't see them, and Chris and I would say this all the time. We never saw the Bulls beating them, even when Derrick Rose came back and he got hurt. I mean, before that, I'm saying when he got hurt and everything like that, and they were there was, you know, when Rip Hamilton was there and all that other stuff. You know, we just never saw them beating LeBron James because it's LeBron James, and they didn't answer the question at the 2 or they didn't answer the question at the three, which was getting in another guy who could create his own shot and somebody else that they have to worry about on the offensive end, somebody who can actually dribble, that LeBron James would actually have to go guard, that Dwayne Wade would actually have to go guard. So they never answered those questions. So I think that they were close, like Eastern Conference, all the time. I think it would have gotten there. In my Bulls heart, they would have beaten LeBron James once. That's just the sea red in me speaking right now, saying they would have beaten LeBron James one time and we wouldn't gotten over it. I mean, but even take into account also the year, and I don't know if I'm getting ahead of this or not, but the year that Derrick Rose and Jimmy Butler and Gasol did play together when Rose hit that, you know, incredible three off the glass. Mm-hmm. They had their chance right then and there. They won that next game. That we win. It's 3-1. They're not coming back from that. And what happened? LeBron James went LeBron James. Like, that simple. He told his coach, sit down. You know, don't call a timeout. Don't mess up. And then he goes and hits a shot in Jimmy Butler's face, and the series is over. So I think it would have been stuff like that would have happened to the Bulls in this era. So. It would have been close, but I don't know. It's hard for me to say that they would have won one, but they would have been close.
Not really. They weren't beating LeBron James. They just weren't doing it, and because we've seen it on the other end with Michael, and when you have a guy who's 6'9", your best player is 6'3", and then you have Dwayne Wade running around not guarding anybody because he doesn't have to, you're gonna lose. They said we needed someone else on a team that could dribble the damn basketball, and they did not have anybody else that could dribble the ball. Rose was way easier to guard for LeBron James, and he clamped them down. So besides that, small, minute chance, maybe an injury or two for Miami, maybe. But nah, I never had him beating Miami.
If Rose was healthy, do you think he and Jimmy Butler would have developed into a pretty special backcourt, or do you think that maybe there was just too much friction there? And I'll start with you, Chris.
I think Jimmy Butler would have left at some point, regardless. Given what we've seen from him the last few years, and also what he displayed in the playoffs against Boston, and you know his willingness to—I don't know—I'm not quite sure what he wants in the NBA. I know he wants money, of course, but like everyone does, we all want money, but. I think he was destined to want to get out under the shadow of Derrick Rose, especially if Derrick Rose never got hurt. I mean, that shadow would have been huge. But who's to say though? Maybe they do win. Maybe they go to the finals once. Do you hang around to see you win a championship, or do you build up your resume because you look good? You went to the finals, and you can leave it and get a better payday because you won a team that won some games. But I don't know. I think his personality, the way he is right now, for what we know, I think he would have at some point left the Bulls in that stay, especially, the coaching, Tibbs. I think he would have left.
Well, they've developed into something special. I hope so. But like Chris said, I don't know, because it's such a weird question, because who knows would Jimmy Butler have grown into this beast if Derrick Rose didn't get hurt? Would he become that player to have the ball in his hands all the time and we're dependent on him and things like that? Who knows what his development would have been? I like to think that he would, good players find a way to be good, as Chris always tells me. But the type of player he is, the mentality, would he have that same one if he was under that shadow of Derrick Rose and he was running the team? I don't know. Like I just mentioned, the time we saw them actually play together, you saw what happened. It was still LeBron James. If LeBron James is there, you can be as special as you want. But if LeBron is there, you got a problem. Can you beat LeBron? And the answer is usually going to be no. And it was a definite no those years, even with Rose being hurt. Now, they had a chance to definitely be something special because Derrick Rose was special. And Jimmy Butler and what he became was a really good basketball player. He could have been that answer for them at that too, over the next few years. But again, there were a lot. It's just a hard question for me to answer because I don't know the mentality Jimmy Butler would have had as far as, getting that ball and, holding it and, playing that ISO basketball that he plays very well. So it'd be interesting though, but I'd like to think that they would have developed into something special.
Guys, I really appreciate you coming on and grading this portion of the Garpax era with me, and look forward to maybe having you guys on again during the regular season.
Thanks, man. Thank you for having us on. Make sure you check out our podcast, Ball on Bulls, at ballsports.com and on any platform you listen to podcasts on.
Of course, you got to get your plug in.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. All right, oh, Bulls Outsiders. Thank you.
Bye. Well, I say, yeah, you got like 10 other things you got to plug. Dude.
I'm done.
Go right ahead. Go ahead. We got 10 minutes. Go down.
I'm done.
Can we go back?
Thank you for listening to the Rebuildable Podcast. Be sure to check out more episodes on Google Play, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and on Rebuildable.com.